podcast of the Historical Institute of the University of Bern. My name is Isabel Schürch, and I'm very much looking forward to today's history talk because we are going to talk about the moon. This year, on the 21st of July, the moon landing, the quote, giant leap for mankind, is celebrating its 50th anniversary, and that gives us plenty of reasons to talk about it. Now, I'm a medievalist, which means that the actual exploration of outer space is something quite distant from my own research. But the fascination with the moon, the planets, and what lies beyond of what can be seen with one's own eyes is something that dates way back. Therefore, I'm very happy that Professor Julia Richers is with me today. Julia Richers is Professor for General and Eastern European History here in Bern, and her main research areas are the history of Russia, the Soviet Union and the Cold War. And, as we all know, the race to the moon is a very prominent example of how the Cold War in the 1950s and 60s was fought. Now, before we start talking about Sputnik, Yuri Gagarin and the American flag, Professor Richers, allow me to ask, how come you're not just interested in history, but you've actually made it your profession?
Well, I guess it was my upbringing and Eastern Europe. First, my parents taught me, always taught me to, or encouraged me to ask critical questions and to question overly simple answers. And so they ask me always to look precisely at things and from different angles. And I guess they were very much my backbone and encouraged me to look at primary sources, at historical sources, and make my own picture. And the second reason, I guess, is, as I mentioned, is Eastern Europe itself, its tragic history in the 20th century, the overlapping histories in this area puzzled me a lot, and they still keep me busy until today, that I want to know about this history a bit more and closer.
Mm-hmm. So, what about the lunar landing then? Most of us here in Switzerland are mainly influenced by the dominant and commonly shared history of the winners. How the American Neil Armstrong made a small step for a man but one giant leap for mankind. So what is your take on this Americanized story of the space race and what can we gain from a Soviet perspective?
As you mentioned yourself, it's a very much Americanized story of the space race. And I think, or I ask myself time and again, why is the one reaching the moon first the winner? Let me explain. From a Soviet's perspective, the winner for a very long time was the Soviet Union. Many people forget that before the moon landing of the Americans in 1969, we had different Soviet space firsts. So the most obvious one was the first artificial satellite Sputnik in 1957, followed only 1 month later by the first mammal, a dog called Laika, in space. And then you had the first lunar probes circling around the moon. And then, of course, you had Yuri Gagarin as the first man in space. So from that perspective, the USSR was the great winner in this whole game. And it shows that in this whole history of the space race, you have these national master narratives, narratives of greatness, of uniqueness. And if you compare the two with each other, you get very interesting overlaps, but of course, quite big differences. So the American moon landing was a key moment in history, that is for sure. But interestingly, the USSR countered this American space first on the moon immediately after the moon landing, saying that the USSR never wanted to reach the moon. They'd rather want to travel to Mars because it's more daring and it's more dangerous to go there. So what this whole story of master narratives on the space exploration shows is that they've always been reciprocal. So always depending on each other and one answering the other. So it was always a story of daring to be more dangerous. And yeah, I guess.
So would you say that the American story wouldn't work as it seems to work without the Soviet
Definitely.
Story?
Definitely, because I think it's very important to stress this point that the American moon landing was an answer to the Soviet space program.
And you've already talked about space exploration, but let us focus for the time being on the moon. So why the moon? How come that the moon, of all places, became such a contested locale, such an actual stage for American and Soviet superpower politics?
Currently, Kennedy's very famous speech to the Congress, to the American Congress, announcing the plan of landing a man on the moon and bringing him back safely to the Earth has been quoted again and again. It's in the media everywhere right now. But what is missing in the media coverage very often is the context in which Kennedy made this speech in front of the Congress, of the two chambers of the Congress. And the context was 1961, and the speech was held by Kennedy just only 1 month after Yuri Gagarin's flight. And it's somehow the United States was in a major crisis concerning its own space program, because the Soviet side appeared invincible in this whole space race. And I think this was, to national pride, this was extremely embarrassing. And if you listen to Kennedy's speech in full length, it's a whole plan to somehow overtake the Soviet Union in this space program. So what they thought about was a plan that was more daring and more dangerous than anything mankind has witnessed before. And, well, it was only technically possible at that time to reach the moon. So Mars wasn't an option, or going to Venus, or anything alike. So the moon, in many ways, was reachable. It was visible from one's own eye, and it is, of course, a celestial body that has a large and a long history of longing and desire of mankind actually reaching the moon. And finally, there's an additional very important aspect rarely mentioned, is and it's that the Soviet Union was very, very close to the moon already. And that doesn't mean that they were planning to put a man on the moon at that time. That wasn't the case. But they had already proven since 1959, so already 10 years earlier than the American moon landing, that they were able to reach the moon. And that was quite threatening to the American side. So it was the Soviet lunar space probe, One missed the moon, I have to admit. But Luna 2 was the first space probe to touch the surface of the moon. It actually hit the moon quite not very softly. And then even more spectacular, Luna 3, which was also in 1959, made the first pictures of the far side of the moon. And that was truly spectacular to the world. So it was the first time ever that that humanity had pictures of that side of the moon nobody ever saw before. And Soviet Academy of Sciences used those pictures to actually remap the moon, and giving the far side of the moon all Soviet and Russian names. And this caused a great protest on the American side, and they had to take back some of the names and add names of Western scientists as well. But still, on the far side of the moon, we have Pavlov, as a name of a creator. We have Tsiolkovsky, which is seen as the founding father of Soviet rocketry. And we have Mare Moskovienze, so the Moscow Sea. And so you see, the far side of the moon isn't very American, it's very Russian. And then just 3 years, I think, before the moon landing, the American moon landing, you had the first lunar space probe achieving a soft landing on the moon. This was Luna 9. In the same year, you had with Luna 10, the first artificial satellite of the moon. So the Soviet Union was in high pace reaching the moon closer and closer. So I think this was an additional aspect why the American side chose to press this project for the American moon landing. Mm-hmm.
But would you say now, from what you've just talked about, that the Soviet, let's say the Soviet way of approaching the moon was in that sense more scientific than the American, more, you know, more concerned with exploring and actually touching and putting a flag on the moon?
That's a very good question. And I think it's yes and no. I think the American moon landing in 1969 was a political endeavor. There was a small scientific part to the Apollo 11 mission, but in general, it was a political mission. It was important for the United States to show that they can have a spectacular space first themselves, because they were lacking behind as a technical leading nation, and so they had to prove that they were technically able to have a great achievement in space.
Mm-hmm. Now we are here at the University of Bern, and if I'm correctly informed, there is a Bernese connection to the whole lunar landing story. And so I have to ask, so what is the role of Bern in all of this? And why is the first lunar landing now also celebrated here in Bern?
It's a very interesting chapter of the Apollo 11 mission. And why the University of Bern is celebrating today this American moon landing is because it was the only non-American institution allowed to participate in this highly national and highly American and American-only project of the Apollo 11 mission. And the reason is still quite impressive. It was a unique selling point the University of Bern had. And, you know, when we talked before about the political implication of this moon mission, and that I said there was a small scientific program added to the Apollo 11 that was highly contested in NASA. So the politicians wanted it to be a national undertaking and showing the American greatness. But scientists said, well, if we do reach the moon, there should be science up there too. And so there was a small set of experiments allowed to travel with the Apollo 11 mission. And the University of Bern had developed a so-called solar wind composition. It was an aluminium foil designed to capture the particles of the solar wind. And it was something that hadn't existed before. So it was the first experiment of its kind to actually do measurements on the solar wind. So there were long negotiations between NASA, the embassy of Switzerland in Washington, the University of Bern, and the Swiss National Science Foundation to make this experiment possible. And at the end, NASA agreed to have this solar wind composition from the University of Bern included in the capsule. And it's a funny fact that this aluminium foil from Bern was unraveled and deployed before the American flag was put on the moon. And this was simply for exposure reasons. So it had to be exposed for a longer time. I think it was exposed for 77 minutes or something like that. And that's why this whole solar wind composition experiment has been nicknamed the Swiss flag experiment on the moon. And actually, you can say the Swiss were first.
I really love this story. And but now I have to ask a very... It's the kind of questions only historians can ask. So I think today, when we're celebrating the lunar landing, here in Bern, I see books and pictures, and so the lunar landing is everywhere. And I think also the awareness that Bern had its role to play. But do you know anything about how this was discussed at the time, so in 69? Was Bern, did Bern become famous at the time, or was this something that was not really discussed, or was not really shown, was not some, not part of the media coverage of the lunar landing here in Switzerland?
I guess, well, in international media coverage, it wasn't a topic, as far as I know. And but it was covered by Swiss media, so it was reported that Bern had a had an impact on the scientific part of the Apollo 11 mission. But somehow it got forgotten. Very much. And it's only now, of course, 50th anniversary is always a good reason to go back to the archive and look at the documents. And it's also the physics department doing a great job undigging this story. The University of Bern decided to uncover this story and give it more space, if you wish, to show that there was an international component, a tiny, tiny international component in this national endeavour.
Mm-hmm. So anniversaries are very unique occasions for historians to, as you said, go back to the archives, digging in archives. Was this also the case for you, that you knew, okay, now we have the 50th anniversary coming up. I would like to be part of it, and I would like to learn more about it.
Actually not, no, because I've been, the cosmos or outer space has kept me busy for, I guess, for the last 15 or more years. So, especially the Soviet cosmos. So the Soviet side of the space program. So it wasn't the anniversary itself, but of course, it's in times of such anniversaries that scientists get asked about their opinion or about their findings, and since the American side of the story has been told so many times, I think it's the Soviet and the Swiss side to the story that makes it interesting and new in some way. And what I like about the Swiss story very much is it's always neat if you can link local micro history to macro. Like to the big history with a capital H. And I think also for students it's highly interesting to get to know that there are plenty of documents in the archive of the university and in the archive of the physics department they can have a look at and write papers about. And so I have two master theses right now being written on the participation of the University of Bern. In a moon landing.
So let's get back to your own research. But I first have to ask a really, really important question. Why are we talking about Russian cosmonauts but American astronauts?
It's not so simple a question. It's quite difficult to answer. The Russian side always used the cosmonauts. So astronauts was to my knowledge, never used. And the reason probably is in the term itself. So cosmonauts means sailors into the cosmos. So sailing the cosmos, which is somehow more precise than sailing to the stars, since at that time, interplanetary travel, so travel to other stars, was not something feasible. It was not possible at that time, technically speaking. But somehow the Americans favored the term astronauts. And there's also an astronautical union already established in 1950. So somehow they decided on two different terms. And it has stayed that way ever since. You could always make a very political statement in the times of the Cold War if you talked about cosmonauts or astronauts, because it was clear that you either meant the American side or the Soviet side.
Mm. That it was not a common project in that sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, your comparative approach allows us to compare different stories that are told in different national contexts. We started our talk with the alleged winners of the space race, the Americans, but you've made it clear that we shouldn't forget about the Soviet success story too. So in that context, do you also see a difference between the kinds of heroes that were created?
Well, both were heroes. The cosmonauts and the astronauts were national heroes. Well, national in the Soviet sense doesn't make much sense, but there were superheroes actually. And what is equally similar is that both had to appear as ordinary men, even though they were extremely extraordinary. I mean, still today you can count the people who have reached outer space. So they had to be ordinary men. In the American context, you always heard this term, they are all American boys. And both of them, and this is an additional similarity, were fighter pilots by education. So they had this military background, and so these are the similarities, but there are also many differences between these two types of heroes, the cosmonauts and the astronauts. So for the American astronauts, it was very clear that they had to be white, male, and Christian, for sure. And there's no exception to that. And in the Soviet case, the cosmonauts had to be atheists, and they had to prove atheism in space, so showing or proving that they have not seen a god up there. And they had to be of proletarian origin, so proletarian background. So if in Gagarin's case, it was very often emphasized that his father fought in the Second World War. He was killed by the Germans during German occupation of the Western Soviet Union. He came from an extremely poor background, and he made it all the way to the space program and finally to space itself. And so there was a great success story in the Soviet Union, showing that the poorest of the poor can achieve unimaginable aims. And for the Soviet side, we can also say there was a woman in space. Valentina Tereshkova was in 1963 the first woman ever in space, and the Americans didn't like that project at all, and they insisted that women will not enter the NASA space program for sure, and they didn't. And the first woman, the American woman, only reached space in 1982. So more than 20 years later. And so a woman in space at that time was unthinkable. So you see, those space heroes, those spacefarers in some ways were similar, and still there were crucial differences between the two.
Mm-hmm. Now, following up on that, I have a very personal interest question, because I myself, I'm working on human-animal relationships in a historical perspective. So everyone remembers the human heroes, the ones you've just mentioned, Yuri Gagarin, Neil Armstrong, and so on. But what about the non-human beings involved in a space race? Doesn't a small step for a man and the giant leap for mankind story frame the narrative in a too limited way? Shouldn't we talk and remember all the American and Soviet animals and their small steps, or rather their small flights into outer space too?
Of course we should. There were plenty of animals in space, and not just bacteria and fruit flies and rats and the like, but also dogs on the Soviet side and monkeys on the American side. And in the Soviet case, the dogs of the Soviet space program are being remembered very much. So there's at least one statue that was erected for Laika, the first dog in space, that died a very cruel death in space. And this dog was remembered, and it was also on stamps, on postcards. There was our own cigarette brand called Laika in the Soviet Union, which is not so funny because Laika burned, and in space, and match boxes were full of Laika. And there were two siblings. There were siblings, Bielka and Strelka, these two small dogs, extremely cute dogs, returning alive from space. So they were the first ones to return alive, and they were treated like superstars in the Soviet Union, and parents really had troubles at home because all small children wanted to have those tiny dogs and have a little bit of cosmos in the living room. And on the other side, for the Communist Party, again, it was very important to stress that those dogs used for the Soviet space program were proletarian crossbreeds and not like pure pedigree dogs, to show that everybody in the Soviet Union may at one point in their life be able to reach moon. And and this is a very, from a cultural history perspective, this is very interesting because it shows that at that time when traveling, like free travel in the Soviet Union, was something very rare. So reaching the West was something only privileged people in the Soviet Union could ever reach. So it was this hope that reaching the moon is more likely than reaching Western countries was something that kept people quite busy in their minds.
Now, we've talked about dogs, the moon, superpower politics and the role of Bern in the midst of it. And I would like to finish our talk with the last question that actually brings us back to your work as a historian. What do you think is our biggest challenge as historians today?
I really think it's fake news and the post-factual age, this post-truth age. I find that quite scaring, and I also think that the moon landing itself fits here very well, because as we all know, there are plenty of conspiracy theories concerning the American moon landing until today. And I'm sure media will cover and show those documentaries on containing those conspiracy theories now during the anniversary as well. But I think it's you just need to look at the documents of the University of Bern and or look at the Soviet coverage of the American moon landing to know that the moon landing did happen. And so teaching students to go back to the sources at Fontes and looking at those sources is one of our great tasks in teaching history at the university.
Dear Professor Ries, thank you very much for having been such a great guest of our podcast series. We hope you've enjoyed the talk as much as we have, and thank you for listening.